Hello and welcome back to the Stanford Psychology Podcast. Welcome back from summer break. Thank you for indulging us over the summer. Hope you enjoyed our re-aired episodes. We are back today with a new episode, woohoo, with Matt Abrahams, leading expert in the field of communication and lecturer at Stanford University's Graduate School of Business. Matt is a highly sought-after keynote speaker and communications consultant. He has helped numerous presenters prepare for high-stakes talks, including Nobel Prize award presentations and appearances at TED and the World Economic Forum. His online talks garner millions of views, including many views from me, and he hosts the popular award-winning podcast, Think Fast, Talk Smart, the podcast. In this chat, we discuss all things public speaking and stage fright, introducing Matt's upcoming book, Think Faster, Talk Smarter, How to Speak Successfully When You're Put on the Spot, which provides tangible, actionable skills to help even the most anxious of speakers succeed when speaking spontaneously. I hope you enjoy this conversation. Welcome back to the Stanford Psychology Podcast, where this week I am so excited to be talking about talking to Matt Abrahams. Thank you so much for making the time.
Really excited to be here with you, Eric. Thank you.
All right. Public speaking, private speaking, speaking is hard. I want to start off by getting a hot take from you because nothing bad ever came after people gave their hot take on something. I would like to know, what is some common advice on speaking that you think is just wrong? That is overrated, overvalued. People should stop giving this advice to people about speaking.
For me, that's really easy. And many people are given the advice to memorize their content, to learn it word for word, to be able to recite it back as if it's exactly the way you wrote it. And in fact, that works exactly against you. And for those of your listeners, I know who have some experience in psychology and are familiar with cognitive psychology, it really boils down to cognitive load. When you give yourself the right way, and I put that in quotes, of saying something, you have now given yourself something to fixate on, something to compare against, and all of that takes effort and bandwidth to do, which means you have less of that energy, effort, and bandwidth to apply to the actual communication, the connecting, the adapting, the really learning from the person you're speaking to. So, the biggest bad advice that I believe exists in the world of communication and speaking is memorize your content.
Wow. Seems related to over-preparing. I know when I started the podcast, I had every single question I was going to ask worded out entirely. The full sentence, question mark at the end. At the end, if I was missing the question mark, I was getting really nervous during the conversation. I was like, oh no, how do I end the intonation at the end of the sentence? But over time, it seems like that was not the most useful strategy.
That's right. And my hunch is you feel much more relaxed and connected to those you're speaking to now that you're not reading every question all the way to the final punctuation. And that's true. Now, it does take a little bit of a leap of faith and trust in yourself. But with some mindset changes and a little bit of practice, you can get yourself to a point where you don't feel like you have to have every single thing scripted.
How much do people get nervous about speaking when they speak to small audiences versus big audiences? So one thing I find helpful with this podcast, for example, is that I can succumb to the illusion that no one listens as we're talking right now because there's not 5,000 people sitting next to us. That would make me very nervous. How much does anxiety scale with the size of the audience?
I've listened into your podcast for a while now, and I know a lot of people listen. So that's a little mind game you're playing with yourself. For when it comes to anxiety, people really vary. Some people, the larger the group, the more at ease they feel because people are more anonymous in a large group. For other people, it's a smaller group because they're more known and individuated. So, you know, size of an audience can vary by person, but certainly the size matters, who's in the audience matters, how prepared you are matters, the goal you're trying to achieve matters. When it comes to anxiety, there are a lot of what I call sources, the things that initiate and exacerbate anxiety. And for some people, audience size is one of the key factors. For others, it's not so much that, it's who's in the room or the goal that you're trying to achieve. So It really, for people, it varies a lot.
What happens when people do get anxious? When I get stage fright, maybe because I'm standing on a stage, but maybe I just get nervous talking to one person in private because I am intimidated by them, for example. What do I do? Zen meditation, sit down, pretend the anxiety isn't there?
So I heard you ask two questions. So let me answer both. So the first question is, why do we get nervous? And the second is, what do you do about it? So those of us who study anxiety believe that this is built into being human. It's part of who we are. When we speak in front of other people, we experience, or many of us experience that as threatening. And we believe it comes back to our relative status within an organization. So when I'm up in front of you, I'm actually putting my status at risk. And I'm not talking about the status of who's got the fancy title or drives a nice car or has more social media likes. I'm talking about evolutionary status, relative status in a hierarchy. And if your status is in jeopardy, it can actually lead to some pretty severe negative consequences. And so it makes sense that when our status is on the line that we get nervous. Now, that said, even though it's part of being human, it doesn't mean that we can't learn to manage it. And that gets to your second question, what can we do about it? And there are lots of things that we can do. Again, for your audience who's psychologically minded, there's a lot of cognitive behavioral therapy that we can, techniques from that we can do. Taking deep belly breaths can slow down the whole syndrome that we get into. We can do things in terms of the way we reframe the situation cognitively. If we see ourselves as in service of our audience and make it more about them than about us, it can feel less anxiety prone. If we become more present oriented and not worried so much about the future consequences and just focus on the moment, that can help us. And then reminding ourselves that in communication, we're not really performing. There is no right way to do it. There are probably some wrong ways, but really it's about what's better and what's worse. And if we can take that pressure of doing it right away, all of a sudden we can really work to converse, connect with our audience. So there are lots of things we can do to learn to manage our anxiety for sure.
And it seems that the anxiety can start before the talk even starts. So some people, certainly not talking about myself here, might feel like an imposter and might say, let's say, my research, no one would care about it. Why would I talk about it? I don't deserve to be on stage. Someone else should be on stage. How do you think about anxiety getting in the way before people even volunteer or sign up to speak publicly?
Anticipatory anxiety is very real. Absolutely. And it has its origins in lots of things like imposter syndrome, like prior experience, etc. It is a very real thing. Anticipatory anxiety is correlated with experienced anxiety, but they don't always have to be correlated. There are people who get really nervous in advance and then in the moment find their place of zen and are able to do it very well. And then there are people who don't get nervous preparing, but at the moment of do. But it is very real. And some of the techniques that we've talked about can serve you well in those states of preparation. There are also some things we can do that I call communication hygiene that can negatively impact our communication and our preparation to communicate. For example, staying up late or not sleeping well as you prepare, that doesn't help you. Taking a lot of caffeine in to think, oh, I really, this will help me prepare, that can work against you as well. We have to have good hygiene as well as do some of these other techniques like deep breathing, reframing, reminding myself that I'm in service of my audience. All of that can help with some of that, the anticipatory anxiety as well.
So we talk about people who maybe have a lot to say, but they're too anxious to say it. They think no one will care when actually a lot of people do care. There is the opposite group of people, I heard. People who think they have so much to say and talk all the time and take up so much space and there's actually no substance behind it, right? So I imagine any good speaking advice would have to be tied to the idea that you should only speak in public if you actually have something to say and your ideas are actually worth hearing. How do you think about the danger of some charismatic, overconfident people learning how to speak in an engaging way, but then not really saying anything of use?
Yeah, so clearly, we want to make sure that when we speak, we use our time wisely and say things that are important, impactful, relevant to our audience. Could you use the techniques that I and others who focus on communication teach to, in essence, train yourself to say nothing important? Probably. My experience is that people who don't add value aren't invited or to the situations that others attend, and there's a selection bias against them. Now, certainly there are people in positions of status and power who aren't as efficient in their communication, opt not to make it relevant or concise. But I have found in my many years of doing this that people who don't have much value to add are often removed from situations where they have opportunities to add it. So that said, I think all of us who teach communication and coach communication need to really emphasize to people that when you speak, you are being given an opportunity from others, and you should take advantage of that opportunity. So figure out how to make your content concise, clear, and relevant, so you don't waste people's time, so you add value rather than detracting.
What about introversion? So I'm still somewhat of an introvert. I used to be extremely introverted. And it might be possible for me to say, okay, my ideas are worth hearing. I should talk to people. But it's just so exhausting to talk to people. What is your advice, your speaking advice for introverts?
So introversion, as you correctly framed it, is really about energy. It's not about anxiety. You can be a confident introvert. You can also be a very nervous introvert, but you can also be a very nervous extrovert as well. So it's really about energy and harnessing that energy and building up the stamina needed and deciding when and how best to use that energy. So for example, if you are an employee in an organization who's introverted, you might say, in a given week, I've got X number of meetings. In some of those meetings, I'm just providing updates. In other meetings, I'm actually leading it or contributing to a discussion. And you might choose to find other vehicles or channels to do your updates. So the update doesn't have to be live necessarily. Maybe you record a video. Maybe you type it up. You share it in other ways that aren't as draining for you, so that you save that energy that you have for the right type of communication. So part of it, I think, is just figuring out how to dole out and prioritize your communication. It's also giving yourself permission to take those breaks and resting, to give yourself that time to rejuvenate. A lot of us, and I think the pandemic didn't help, schedule ourselves back to back, meeting to meeting, and we don't give ourselves that time, regardless of an introvert or extrovert, if for no other reason, to just reflect on what's working, what's not working, catch our breath, etc. So I think part of it is, again, how you schedule your time and how you prioritize. And then it requires you to be creative to fulfill your communication obligation, but perhaps in a way that's not this face-to-face draining experience for you.
One common speaking advice is not saying words like, you know, all the time. Filler words can be very obnoxious to listen to, and one common advice is never say them. How big of a problem do you think that is, and what can we do about it?
Filler words, verbal graffiti, whatever you want to call them, can be very distracting. And that's the big problem, is when you are communicating, you are asking your audience to pay attention and focus. And anything that distracts from that focus is working against you. The reality is this: filler words are normal and natural. Most people have them. So it's not about eliminating them totally. It's about reducing them so they don't become distracting. In fact, screenwrites, playwrights, people who write for television, movies, plays, they actually build in some filler words, some awkward pauses into dialogue to make it sound human and real. So again, the goal is not elimination. The goal is to reduce so you're not distracting. So how do you do this? This is hard because these are habits. And in fact, in the research, the developmental psychology research, there's evidence that filler words are actually very useful for learning. So parents, when they teach young children, will often use filler words or whatever's culturally specific for that culture to signal what's following is an important or new concept. So kids learn to tune in to those ums and ahs because they know what tends to follow them is new and interesting. So there is purpose behind these. So how do you get rid of them or manage them or reduce them? One is awareness building. You have to know that you're doing it. You can't rid yourself of something you're not aware you're doing. So how do you build awareness? You can try to do it on your own. It's hard. You could get a trusted other to give you feedback. There are lots of apps and tools that will help you. So for example, there's an app called Say It Like, because so many people say and so as filler words, where you purchase it on your phone. It's not super expensive, but does cost some money. And when you go to speak, you turn the app on and it will notify you every time you use a filler word that you identify you want it to pay attention to. So it will beep, buzz, or bing every time you say one. And you're like, oh, I just said one. And oh, I just said one. Sometimes the people I work with sounds like jingle bells. It's going off so much. Other times it's just periodic. But that awareness then allows you to begin to look for patterns, for example. I coached an individual who was an engineer. He had lots of ums and uhs. It turned out by doing this process I'm describing, we learned that he tends to say his filler words most frequently in front of complex ideas or terminology. And while it was hard for him to manage his filler words, he certainly knew when he was going to say something complex or use a particular term. So he became extra vigilant before and was able to reduce. A lot of it is awareness building. A lot of it is tools. And there's some other more advanced techniques that have to do with breathing that people can employ. But I just want people to take away that there are things you can do, but the goal is not elimination. The goal is just reducing so you're not being distracting.
What is the correlation between being engaging on stage and being engaging off stage? So if you hear someone talk and they give a wonderful presentation on stage, and then you talk to them off stage, is it likely that you will be absolutely bored, that they are a completely different personality? Are there just people who are always engaging? How interconnected are the two?
So I think it is really important for us to be authentic. We need to be who we are. Now, when we speak in front of a large group, be it in a meeting, a presentation, a pitch, I believe there's some things we should do to help the audience focus, to help them pay attention, and to help them really learn our material. So I would anticipate that we would do things a little differently when we are in that situation. That said, it should not be diametrically opposed to who we are. So if you were to speak to me conversationally and you were to see me speak on a stage, it should feel like I'm the same person, but perhaps I'm dialing up a few things, like gesturing a little more broadly, varying my voice a little bit more. Maybe I'll take a poll or ask more questions. But again, these are tools that I'm using to adjust and adapt to my situation, but they're still based on fundamentally who I am. So to answer your question, I would hope that when people see a speaker up in front of people and then meet the person behind the scenes or interpersonally, that they feel the same. They would probably, and I hope they do, leverage different techniques for engaging simply because when you're up in front of a lot of people, there are just different things you can and should do than when you're in front of people interpersonally. But we want to be authentic in the same person for sure.
Is US style small talk one way of practicing how to be engaging? So this is a very cultural question I'm asking because I'm German, but living in the US, I feel like in the US, I constantly have to practice how to say something interesting when people ask me, how are you doing? In Germany, I never talk to people. I was in Finland a while ago and I spent a whole day without seeing anyone talk to each other. Now that's a bit of an exaggeration and just the most kindness coming from the kindest place.
But I think it might be more idiosyncratic to you than perhaps to a whole country. But yeah, no, there are certainly culture plays a big role in all communication. And that's very clear. And cultures vary in lots of dimensions related to communication. I'd like to challenge, though, the premise of the question, which is that when I engage in small talk or conversation, that I always have to be interested. Mm-hmm. I would argue that, and this is not my line, somebody I interviewed for my own podcast, Rachel Greenwald, shared this line with me. And it's the goal is not to be interesting. The goal is to be interested. Mm-hmm. And in small talk and conversation, there are lots of things you can do to demonstrate your interest in what the other person is saying, which ultimately makes small talk much easier. It could be asking questions. It could be contributing, but in a way that's supportive of the content that's being said rather than switching the content. It can be simply nonverbally nodding your head or saying, huh? So there are lots of ways to signal interest that take pressure off people from being interesting. To do well in small talk, I think, is to just go in thinking, hey, I'm very curious. I want to learn something in this interaction. And that can be very helpful and also takes a lot of pressure off that people feel.
What about humor? What about the role of being funny, specifically if, let's say, you have a horrible sense of humor that no one shares?
So humor is very tricky. It is a wonderful engagement tool. You can really engage people nicely, interpersonally, or in front of a big crowd with humor. The trick is humor is doesn't always land, and we're not everybody is funny. So I joke with my students when I teach engagement techniques that humor is like grad school level engagement. It's really tricky. You have to do some research and preparation in a way, but humor can be delightful. I have a few rules for humor, and I have a suggestion for people who are really interested in working on their being funny and in a work constructive workplace. So my first rule is this: whenever you use humor, focus group it. If you know you're going to use some humor that you're planning in advance, test the joke out with people, go up to more than one person and get their feedback. And most importantly, listen to what they say. If people say it's not funny, don't think to yourself, oh, you just don't have a sense of humor. I'm going to go find somebody else. Because eventually somebody will politely say, oh, that's funny. The other thing is, if you are to use humor, it should self-deprecating humor, humor about yourself is probably the safest type to try. I have two colleagues at Stanford's Business School, Jennifer Ocker and Naomi Bagdonis. They wrote an amazing book called Humor Seriously. They teach a class at the business school. They have a TED talk on the topic. They really break down what makes for humor, how to deploy humor in a work context. It is one of the very few business books I've ever read where I laughed out loud at the way they talk about humor. So it's an engaging read and a very helpful read. So humor is useful. You just have to use it very carefully.
What about academics specifically? So there are a lot of academics listening to this podcast. What are they particularly good or bad at when it comes to presenting their research, let's say, at a conference compared to non-academics?
So academics can be excellent speakers. Some of my most admired presenters are academics, several of whom have been on your show. So there's a stereotype, I think, that academics can't really talk well to non-academic audiences. And certainly there are examples of that, but that's not the case. What I think academics can do really is they're very passionate and they're very knowledgeable. And many academics teach, and they understand that part of teaching is making content relevant and focused on the audience. So a lot of skills that make people good academics, good researchers, good teachers apply to good communication in general. Now, where many academics make a mistake is they give too much detail. Many of us, academics, engineers, scientists, feel like we have to walk people through our logic to help them understand where we're coming from. And to an academic audience, that might be very important. But to a more lay audience, I think that can get in your way. My mother has this saying, I know she didn't create it, but she's the one I attribute it to. And it's very simple. It's tell me the time, don't build me the clock. And many academics are clock builders, right? We need to explain everything. We need to caveat everything. And certainly in our professional lives, that's important. But if I'm trying to speak to a non-academic audience, really concision, relevance, engagement, those are all the things that are very useful. So I work with lots of academics to help them translate. And I think that's a good way of thinking of it. It's not a different beast. It's just translating what you currently do to work better for the audience you're speaking to.
Yeah. So as someone who feels entirely called out by this one follow-up question, how do you sit with this discomfort of having thought about a topic for so long? I've read all these books, all these papers about this topic. I want these people to know, especially my advisors, all these professors. I need them to know I'm smart. I did all my research. I need to tell them everything I know, which of course is not going to work. I need to focus on a few ideas. How do you sit with this discomfort of trying to tell people you've done your work?
I think there are ways to show people that you know what you're talking about without having to go through a literal list of all the background experience. I've seen that done very well. I spend a lot of time with my MBA students talking about showing versus telling. So if I can show you through the work I've done or explain examples, then you see my credibility come through. It's also about prioritization. A lot of academics and technicians and scientists think that to make something accessible to a non-technical or academic audience, that you have to dumb it down. And I think that's wrong. I think there are lots of ways to make complex ideas accessible without having to simplify, using analogies, deconstructing ideas, chunking ideas into similar concepts. These are all ways to take complex information and make it accessible without dumbing it down. And we have to realize that not everybody needs to know things to the level that we do. And if our job is to be in service of our audience, to inspire our audience, to get them to be interested in what we're doing, giving them too much information might actually work against us.
You are writing a new book. And by the time that this podcast will be out, I believe your book will be out. What is your book going to be about? And how is it different from your previous book?
Thank you for the opportunity to share. So my new book is called Think Faster, Talk Smarter. Based on a lot from the podcast I do called Think Fast, Talk Smart. And it really focuses on the issue of what I call spontaneous speaking, speaking in the moment. Most of our communication training, if we ever get any of it, is focused on planned presenting. I have a presentation or a meeting coming up in a few weeks. I get to think about it. I create slides. I might even practice or run it by other people. But that only makes up a relatively small percentage of our communication. Most of our communication is spontaneous. Somebody asks you a question. Your colleague asks you for feedback. You make a mistake and you have to fix it. You find yourself in a situation where you have to do small talk. Most of our communication is in the moment, spontaneous in nature. And there really isn't a lot of advice and guidance out there on this. And so the new book really focuses on a methodology that I developed at Stanford's business school. Many years ago, I was asked by the deans to help with a problem we had. We have incredibly bright students who were really struggling on cold calls. And I know you, as somebody who teaches and has been in academia for a long time, you know what a cold call is. That's where the professor points at you and says, what do you think? Yep. And you have to respond. But that can be very pressure filled. And our students were not performing up to their own expectations or the professor's expectations. So I developed a methodology based on research from psychology and sociology and biology and theater and improvisation. And there's a 6-step methodology I walk people through. And then I give some very specific examples for specific situations to help. So it's really designed to help people feel more comfortable and confident in those spontaneous moments. The prior book I wrote is really focused on anxiety management and how do we manage anxiety? And once our anxiety is managed, how do we create clear, concise, compelling content from a more confident point of view?
I will have to ask you to give us a little bit of a preview here. So my professor is cold calling on me. What do I do?
Yeah. So first thing you do is you see this as an opportunity. Many of us, when we find ourselves in spontaneous speaking situations, we see this as something we have to dread or defend against or try to minimize. And in fact, these are opportunities to engage, to collaborate, to share. So the first step is really a mindset shift, and that is to see it as an opportunity. We then need to give ourselves permission to just respond. Many of us get into our heads and start judging and evaluating, so much so that it can be paralyzing to us. So we have to have this leap of faith where we actually say, okay, I know my stuff. I'm going to be able to do this. I have the audacity in my MBA communication classes to tell my students to strive for mediocrity. And these are students who have never been told that. And the reason for this is that when you try right and great, that puts so much pressure on yourself that it's really hard to do it at all. But if you just strive on getting it done, in other words, just accomplishing what needs to be accomplished, you actually have extra cognitive bandwidth to do it really well. So the full saying I tell my students is strive for mediocrity so you can achieve greatness. So we have to reframe it as an opportunity. We have to get out of our own way and not put so much pressure on ourselves. And then the key is to structure your response. So in a Q&A situation, I have a very specific structure I like to lead people through, which serves as a recipe, if you will, to answer a question. Now, it's like a formula, but it doesn't sound formulaic when you actually use it. So the 3 steps, if you boil it down, are really a mindset shift, a getting out of our own way, in other words, freeing up cognitive resources, and then having a structure that tells you how you will say what you will say. So all you have to do is plug information in. That's how you manage a cold call. That's how you manage most spontaneous speaking situations.
I want to build on that first point. So seeing speaking as an opportunity, not as an obligation. We have talked a lot about how to speak, but not why to speak, because a lot of people might dread it just because they don't see any joy in it. Oh God, it's something I have to do. Can you speak a little bit as someone who seems to enjoy speaking? What is the joy of speaking?
I do indeed.
What do you like about it? I hope. Yeah.
Yeah. No, so I thoroughly enjoy speaking. I thoroughly enjoy listening to other people communicate. It's, to me, it is one of the most fundamental ways we connect. If you think about it, the term communication is derived from a Latin term to commune, to find commonality, to connect. And that's really what I think communication does. Now, that doesn't mean we agree all the time. It doesn't mean that it's always happy and positive. But to me, I love to learn. I love to connect. And I love to really have a moment where two people are committed to the same concept. And that to me is really motivating. And for people I work with who are less eager to communicate, I try to help them see the value that they bring to the interaction and the value that they can provide to others. And in that, they can find some motivation and some excitement to get across. I'm often asked, Derek, I teach the same class and have for 12 years, twice a quarter, every quarter. So I teach the same material. I love it. It changes, of course. I evolve the course. But people are like, how can you keep teaching the same thing? And I say, not only am I so passionate about what I teach, but every time I bring up these ideas, I am in a different connection with different people. And that's a different experience. So for me, while it looks on the outside like it's the same thing, every interaction is different. And I relish that. I enjoy it very much.
How is your thinking about talking evolved over time? Is there something you used to believe 10 years ago and now you say, I see that differently, or I am building on it and I see it all in a new light?
Let me give you two answers. One is an easy one, just because we've all experienced it. I used to think that real communication had to happen in person. The pandemic changed my view on that. You can have meaningful, deep, detailed communication and not be physically present with people. There are times where I think being in person is better, can be more helpful, but I was biased towards direct in-person communication. So I've had an evolution on my thinking about the role of technology in communication. Is it perfect? No. Is it the only option? No. But I've changed and I've evolved. The other thing that I used to believe is similar to what you said and we talked about earlier, which is this notion of you have to be totally prepared and practiced to have any chance of being good at it. And over time, in many years of doing this work, I've learned that some level of preparation and practice are important. But that being in the moment, trusting yourself, seeing things as opportunities, as we recently discussed, can really make a difference. So I've had an evolution on the degree to which I need to practice and prepare over the decades I've been doing this that have changed.
What still puzzles you? What aspect of communication is something you think about and you say, I don't really know. I'm not sure I understand this aspect.
With my tongue firmly planted in my cheek, I will say the communication I have with my two teenage kids, I am befuddled. And it's highly ironic that somebody who studies communication has done research in it. I still struggle to communicate with two teens. But and related to that, a thing that still I'm fascinated by, passionate about, trying to better understand is how we actually leverage ambiguity to be successful in our communication. The model of communication is always be as clear and concise as you can be. And then that's very important for a lot of communication, certainly. But we accomplish a lot of our communication goals through ambiguity. And I am fascinated by that. And I continue to inquire into that and try to figure that out. So for me, the puzzle I'm still trying to solve is the role of ambiguity in communication, how we leverage that ambiguity and what more we can do as a result of that ambiguity.
Two interrelated personal questions. When did it all start? Basically, when did you become interested in speaking? And when did you become a good speaker? Were you an adolescent, a child, an infant?
I will thank you for the latter compliment. I still see myself as having to develop my communication skills. So thank you for saying that you find me a good speaker. I still see a lot of work to do. A couple things happened in my schooling, my last name being Abraham's A.B., we used to always be alphabetical order by last name. So I always went first. There's only one time in my entire academic career where there was somebody who was before me alphabetically. So I got used to being the person who always went first. And so I think at a young age, that was just out of repetition, something I whenever any class activity, I virtually was certain that I would go first. And that's why, by the way, in my classes, I rarely use alphabetical order. Because I suffered through that. So that's part of it. And then the other piece was in my high school freshman English first day of class, we all had to stand up, and this was pretty traditional. The teacher would say, tell the class what you did this summer. And I told a story about what I did this summer. And the teacher pulled me aside and said, hey, that story was really interesting. You did a good job. I'd like you to go to this speech tournament. Every English teacher had to nominate one student to go to a speech tournament. And I went. I had a very traumatic experience there. But ultimately, as a result of that, I found that it was something that I enjoyed doing and that I had some sense of agency in. And that's what really got me interested in communication. So a lot of my experience wasn't through formal training early on in my schooling. It was just by experience, really, that led to my interest in communication.
You have written a book. Now you have written another book. You have a podcast. You're doing so many things on so many fronts. But it seems like there was one talk that you gave that was uploaded to YouTube that just blew up from the Stanford Graduate School of Business. 28 million views as we talk now. I'm sure by the time this podcast is released, we will be somewhere near 2 billion. Who knows? So what is it like to be famous, YouTube famous? And what happened after this talk came out? Your life changed completely. It was just the same. You wanted it to end. What happened?
Oh, you paint a picture of a life that does not exist. The story behind that talk is just total serendipity. The fact that it became popular is a mystery to me. I am glad that it helps people. It has certainly been people all over the world have seen it, which to me is just really cool as a teacher. I want to help people. And it's nice to know that people have turned to that. And it has given me opportunities to do other things like the podcast, like the book. But no, I am not like some TikTok, Instagram star. Nobody knows. I have had two situations in my life that have been interesting as a relation to that. I was in a Uber once and somebody turned around and said, you're that guy who did that speech. So somebody saw me. And then I had somebody else in line in a jetway to get on an airplane. And somebody asked me a question and I responded. And somebody three people up turned around and said, your voice is really familiar to me. Those are the only two incidents of, I don't even call that fame, just people noticing me. No, nothing has changed in my life directly, but I hope that the talk has helped people feel more comfortable and confident speaking. And if that's the case, then that's all the reward I need.
We want to highlight the different careers that are open to people with a background in psychology. Now, you're not clearly just a psychologist, but one could see that someone with an interest in psychology and a background in psychology might be interested in talking about talking and being a public speaker. And it seems like your career has been very idiosyncratic. There's not a lot of Matt Abrahams out there that I know who have a very similar career path. So take us to an average day in your life might be hard to say because I imagine your days vary a lot, but you could pick a random day last week.
So let me start by saying that I do consider myself a psychologist. I studied psych as an undergrad with in the Stanford Psych Department. I feel very connected to that program. I would argue that at least when I was studying communication, which is what my graduate degree is in, that most folks in the communication field were doing applied social psychology. For sure, the research looked like that. The studies were based on that. So I feel very grounded in that. And I do think that communication is a great avenue for people with psychology backgrounds to explore. IO Psych, doing things around business and organizational behavior, really important, and communication plays a central role. What does an average day in my life look like? There is no average day, but it often will involve some form of teaching or coaching, some form of communicating ideas to others, be it online, through LinkedIn or other posts, or just part of panels and other things. But the one common thread in everything I do is really trying to help others hone their communication skills, and by default, honing my own. So part of what I like about the life I've created for myself is it is varied, but it's grounded in teaching and learning. And I like that very much.
I have one last question on this note of teaching people how to talk better. As someone who also has a podcast, what do podcast hosts commonly do wrong, and what can they do better to make their podcasts more engaging?
You do an excellent job asking thought-provoking questions. Having done your homework, I think, is really important. The thing that bothers me the most is podcast hosts often forget that their job is to be the eyes, the ears, the voice for their audience. So they make it very personal in a way that makes it disconnecting for the audience. That's not to say that we shouldn't tell personal stories and engage in a personal level, but I find the best podcast hosts have a way of connecting us, the listeners, to the person they're talking about or to the content they're talking about. And that to me is what makes good podcasting special. And that's where I advise people who ask me my opinion on what they should do to really connect your audience to the content and to the person.
Wonderful. On that note, thank you so much for joining this podcast. If you want to add any last words, please feel free to do so. But thank you so much. I've learned a lot.
Thank you, Eric. And thank you for this opportunity. You are doing great work. And I would just simply say that if people are interested in learning more about what I do, link in with me. I'm a big user of LinkedIn. I have an Instagram presence. Listen to Think Fast, Talk Smart, the podcast. And I curate a website, abrahams.com, that has a whole bunch of resources that people can leverage to better their communication. So thank you again for the opportunity.
Thank you. Thank you for listening. Following Robert Cialdini's advice here on this podcast, let's see if I can convince you to take about 5 seconds of your valuable time and leave us a quick review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or elsewhere. This podcast has been a labor of love by several wonderful young folks here in the department, and we have been surprised by the ever-increasing reach the podcast has had. We are near 500,000 downloads a year and a half since we started, with tens of thousands of new downloads and thousands of new followers every single month in nearly every country around the world. Help us make even more people excited about psychology by leaving us a review or subscribing to our no spam, all fun Substack at Stanford Psy Pod to connect with other listeners, or shoot us an email with your thoughts or suggestions at stanfordpsychpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you and have a wonderful psyched day.